This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
You're now listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. The rise of Bitcoin and now the talk around Libra, Facebook's fiat-backed stablecoin, have woken up central bankers to the disruptive potential of digital currencies and its implications to the financial system as we know it. Today on The Grill, I'm speaking with Antonio Fadas, Professor of Economics at INSEAD, about the future of money, central banks, and the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Antonio, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Welcome and thank you for having me.
Now, Facebook's proposed cryptocurrency project Libra seems to have woken up central bankers to the threat of private digital currencies. But considering how entrenched and established state-backed currencies are as they are today, should central bankers really be concerned about this?
I mean, I think that project is a very special project. And the reason why it got so much and a strong response from policymakers and regulators is it comes from two places. Number one is that project was defined as a global currency. So it wasn't just a digital form of the US dollar, a digital form of the euro. It was a new currency, Libra, that was supranational and in principle could be adopted by people in countries and become competition to the national currencies. Again, that's something that regulators at central banks were not happy with. I don't think they were under threat. I don't think they felt, in particular in the large countries, that Libra would take over their national currencies, but they're worried about the instability of having two currencies running in parallel. Now, there was a second issue, which is associated to one of the proponents of Libra, which is Facebook. It's a large company, a company that has a lot of power, and a company that has not had a good relationship with regulators for many reasons. So having Facebook backing that currency, I think, was also a wake-up call for regulators that maybe if some of the big tech companies like Facebook enter this market, maybe there could be lack of competition, there could be abuse of power, and there could be an integration into an ecosystem, which is already very powerful.
So essentially, it's Facebook's network effects that really gave Libra that potential disruptive power. But just on a conceptual level, do you think it's realistic for private cryptocurrencies or digital currencies to coexist with fiat currencies?
Again, if you think about how the Libra project has evolved, so the first version of Libra was purely a global currency, sitting above national currencies. The second version of Libra that came out a month ago or so is a very different proposal because it includes the possibility of creating local versions of Libra. So there will be a US dollar Libra. There will be a Euro Libra. Now, when you start talking like this, now this sounds very familiar. It says, look, Facebook, or the Libra Association to be more precise, is going to create a US dollar version of Libra, which is going to look like a US dollar that you have in your bank account, but it's just going to be sitting somewhere else. Can that coexist with the regular US dollar? Sure, we have that in many places. In many countries around the world, people are using electronic wallets, which people don't typically call them cryptocurrencies because they're in US dollars, they're in euros, they're in Singapore dollars. And these are forms of money that coexist with the banking system money. So can I imagine Libra or any other form of electronic wallet to coexist with the current currency? Sure, I think that's a very natural evolution of technology. Now, can I imagine that to be sitting in a decentralized system associated with a technology like blockchain, where there's sort of no one accountable for where that money is and what happens if there's a problem? Then I have doubts. Because I think when it comes to money, we have a very strict regulation for a very good reason, and I doubt any of these new technologies is going to change that.
Just touching on that note of regulation then, because as tech companies become more involved in the fintech or the financial system, how does regulation follow suit here?
So we've seen a big change. At the beginning, regulation was a lot about new currencies. Again, Bitcoin was the perfect example of that. Recently, when you see big tech companies entering into payments, regulation is not so much about new currencies because many of these big tech companies are adopting the currency of the country. They're not creating a new currency. And if you look at China, when you look at WeChat Pay or Alipay, which dominate mobile payments in China, they're using the regular local currency. They did not create a new currency. So what is the fear of regulators at that point? It's about dominance. It's about monopoly power. It's about the fact that these companies, which are omnipresent, that control your mobile life will also control mobile payments. And that's a fear which is very different. It's about competition. It's not so much about new currencies or blockchain, because that's not what WeChat uses. It's more about having these big players monopolizing payments. And obviously, payments are central to the functioning of any economy.
When we talk about the money system, the central banks are a crucial part of that, as it currently stands. And anyway, they print money and they are the lender of last resort. On the flip side, you have proponents of cryptocurrency that like the idea of decentralized systems. I think we've mentioned that, that are outside the influence of governments. I guess the question here is that, are we truly ready for a decentralized system? Because I think you've highlighted some concerns there.
I mean, I don't think we are. I don't think we are for two reasons. First, regulation is there and you cannot avoid it regardless of what technology you use. And second, I'm not sure people are ready to use the form of money that is associated to a decentralized system. Now, decentralized systems can have some advantages, but they also have some disadvantages. The reality is the majority of people would have a large difficulty trying to trade in Bitcoin. If they want to do a Bitcoin payment, it is not a straightforward technology for most people to use. Of course, for people who are very tech savvy and are very much into that world, it feels very natural. But for the majority of the society, that's not true. Same for some of the governance. What if you send Bitcoins to the wrong address? What if you made a mistake? What if you want to get that back? Well, in the Bitcoin world, that's impossible. In the normal banking world, that's possible. You call your bank and you say, I made a mistake. I transferred money to the wrong account. I think most people feel comfortable with a world where there is someone accountable that can reverse transactions. So I don't think the world is ready for a decentralized form of money or payment, again, for both reasons, both because I don't think there is such a large demand for that. And second, regulators need to have accountability.
Now, I think the theme that we've touched on here is that the digitalization of money and payments is not a new phenomenon. I think we saw it with credit cards, with debit cards, with the rise of e-payments like WeChat Pay, for example. And it seems like some central banks, like in China and Sweden, are looking into digital state-backed currencies. And I think this is referred to as central bank digital currencies. With 1 in 10 central banks expected to offer this within the next 3 years, is this the inevitable future of money, digital state-backed currencies?
I mean, I think it's sort of a natural evolution, but it's an evolution that needs to be thought. And I don't think any central bank yet has a solution to some of the issues. Now, first, central bank digital currencies, once again, have been around forever. Central banks have accounts for banks that are digital, and these accounts are central to the payment system of an economy. Again, when I go to a store here in Singapore, the payment that I do to the merchant goes through the central bank. This is true in Singapore. This is true in any country I can think of. So the central bank has always been key in digital payments. Now, what is the difference? What are we talking about when we say central bank digital currencies? We're talking about me as an individual having an account on a central bank, bypassing the banks. Now, why? Why do we do that if the current system functions well? Well, the reason is, as people start using less and less cash, one form of money, which is physical money, will disappear. Now, this form of money happens to be the only form of money that is controlled today by the public sector, because physical cash is still controlled by the central bank. Now, if that money disappears and we all just use our bank money or our WeChat money, then the central bank has zero access to money in an economy, to a provider of money. Now, the central bank digital currency will be a natural evolution to physical paper money. As the world becomes digital, the central bank switches from printing pieces of paper to providing accounts for everyone. Again, that's why I'm saying this is natural. Now, the issue is, as you do that, the financial system needs to adapt, and some of this adaptation is not yet clear how it will happen.
So if the accounts are held with the central bank in this system, where does that leave the commercial banks currently? Are they at risk of being displaced from holding deposits?
Again, it's a little bit the same competition that you have today between the money at your bank and the money in your wallet in physical form. I mean, you could put all your money in physical papers, in banknotes. That's a competition to banks. Why do you take money to your bank? And the reason is they offer a different service. I mean, a bank is more than just a banknote. Now, it is true that if the central bank were to offer accounts, they would be a closer competitor to bank. But it doesn't mean that they're a perfect competitor. The bank can offer you a credit card that the central bank will not be offering you because that's not the business of a central bank. The central bank could limit balances at the central bank account. So if you are a saver that puts a significant amount of money in a bank, the central bank will not take all your money. They will only facilitate a balance that is necessary for payments. So, and that's the open area today where we're trying to figure out the details. How can central bank digital money coexist with bank, regular bank's money without being a competitor in a way that regular banks feel threatened? And in some cases, they see the deposits move away to the central bank. But there are solutions. It's not an impossible task, but we still need to sort out all the details.
What are some of those solutions there?
The most obvious solution is to limit the functionality of those accounts. Again, if the central bank looks like a bank, then the banks are in trouble. If the central bank offers you some nice credit cards with some rewards, like banks offer in some countries, if the central bank allowed you to put as much money as you want, if the central bank pays you a nice interest rate on those accounts, then they're operating fully as a commercial bank. And then most people will say, why bother? Why would I go to a commercial bank if the central bank is safer? So if the central bank kept up in the level of service and possibilities that they offer, of course, this is not going to work. So you have to limit those possibilities. And the way to think about it is this should be thought as just payments. This is not where you save your money. If you want to save your money, you go to a bank. If you want to have a nice credit card with rewards points, go to a bank. Now, you want to have a way of paying at a store which is convenient that runs straight through the central bank, then you can put some money at the central bank. So that's, I think, the natural way to resolve this, and that would not put the central bank in direct competition with banks.
I've been speaking with Antonio Fatas, Professor of Economics at INSEAD. Up next, we'll get into China's digital yuan push and whether a global unified currency is a realistic proposition. Keep it here to The Breakfast Grill to find out.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasan. This morning, I'm speaking with Antonio Fatas, Professor of Economics at INSEAD, and we're taking a look at digital currencies. Now, one of the things I've seen online is that China has been pushing the way forward in terms of when it comes to these state-backed digital currencies. I think it's looking into the digital yuan and even trialing it in some cities. And if this at this rate, it could be the first country to offer a digital sovereign currency. As it stands, China already has one of the best adoption rates when it comes to cashless payments. Could you maybe shed some light into the possible motivations behind this digital yuan push?
So here I'll have to speculate because the Central Bank of China is not always as transparent as one would like. what I get a sense is that the Central Bank of China wants to have an ability to compete with the big tech companies in China that are dominating mobile payments. I think they want to make sure that the whole payment system is not depending on these companies, private companies. And there is a public provision of digital money that can be made available to others. Others means the stores, others maybe means banks, someone else, so that there's not such a dominance of those big tech companies. I think that's the main reason, and I think that's a valid reason. As I said, having a public provision of money the way we've had banknotes forever in history, I think is a reasonable request that the central bank has to satisfy. And that keeps the system balanced between the private sector that can do great things creating different forms of money and the public sector that always guarantees that there's a public option available to everyone, not under the control of someone who's just trying to make money.
Now, just taking a wider view, now, despite its hurdles and its troubles, Libra has brought up the idea of a global digital currency. And late last year, Bank of England Governor Mark Carney suggested replacing the US dollar as the world's reserve currency with a global alternative, which was multi-currency. I think he referred to it as a synthetic hegemonic currency. And this is all, I guess, in a bid to reduce the reliance on the US dollar. Is a unified currency between global central banks a realistic proposition?
I mean, it's an ambitious one. I'm not sure how realistic it is because it's a complicated proposition, but it's an ambitious one, and it's one that makes sense from an economic point of view. Now, this is not a new debate. We have talked for decades about the dominance of the US dollar in world trade, capital flows, et cetera, and how that was a suboptimal solution for everyone, including the US. Now, the problem is, what is the alternative? If you don't use the US dollar, what do you do? Of course, you can try to switch to other currencies. You can try to keep 50% in US dollars, 50% in euros, but that's not an optimal solution. At the end, the optimal solution is to have something that resembles a global currency. So it's not strange to hear a central banker like Mark Carney saying, well, maybe this makes sense. Maybe, in fact, we should try to create this before someone else does. But again, there's a lot of complications about a global currency. We don't have a global central bank. So you first have to write the rules of how this global currency works, who manages, how it gets managed. And obviously, I think what Libra has done is say, well, here is a very simple solution, an incredibly simple solution that says, let's call it a basket. Again, let's not think about the optimal design. Let's just put together a few currencies and we call this Libra. Now, that is not different from what the IMF calls the SDR, which is quote unquote the currency of the IMF. It's not really a currency, but it sort of looks like one. So it's not a new idea either. But maybe this is going to create a momentum for central banks to say, can we get this right? Can we create this global currency in some way and make cross-border payments, global payments, a lot more efficient than they are today? Clearly, cross-border payments is the place where we could see more progress when it comes to payment technology.
Now, just touching on that a little bit, Libra, is, as we mentioned, is will be backed by a basket of currencies, but primarily it's the US dollar. I think that's 50% of the basket. And last year, the chief economist of the IMF, Geeta Gopinath, expressed concern over the proposed currency and the potential for backdoor dollarization. I think this is something we've already touched on here. But do you think this is a legitimate concern from the IMF?
I mean, it is a concern. Of course, Libra has to be pragmatic and you have to choose a basket of currencies that are relevant. Now, today, the US dollar dominates global trade. So if you want to look up, if you want to build a basket of currencies, you have to put the US dollar in there and you have to give it a big weight. So I don't think that's a surprise. It has nothing to do with the US sort of like convincing the Libra Association to do this. It's just that's a natural, valid business proposition. Now, if this were to become a global currency, we go back to the discussion we had a second ago, some countries, in particular the countries with weaker central banks, might end up adopting that currency. That's the tension you have today of dollarization in many economies. How does that tension get resolved? You have capital controls. It is very difficult if you're sitting in Argentina to have an account in US dollars. It's not easy. Not everyone has access to the US dollar. That limits the possibility of dollarization. It doesn't stop it, but it limits it. Now, if you have an account which is fully digital and somehow the Libra Association manages to make this money available to everyone in every country and somehow bypass the capital controls, which is not obvious, but let's assume they can do that, then the fear of dollarization will be enormous. Because it has always been there, but we've managed to stop it through capital controls. But in a world that is digital borderless, capital controls would not be as meaningful. And then we will have a few countries moving into this new currency, call it dollarization or call it Libraization.
So with all this in mind, as we see technology improve and people adopt that technology, payment systems are becoming more efficient and they're basically also they're becoming cheaper. I think that's a very important point to make. And this is through innovation and competition. If we fix the inefficiencies in the payment systems and continue to reduce these fees, whether it's locally or cross-border, do we really need to continue investigating or taking a look at new currencies?
I mean, that's the interesting question that we need to answer today. My view on this is, if you look at some countries, they've already fixed the payment system. Can you ask me the question if we fix them? But in some countries, we've already fixed it. If you do digital payments today through banks, through regular banks, in many countries, these payments are immediate. They're real time. They happen at the same time as you do them. They're costless. The fees are zero in most cases. And even in cross-border payments, we start seeing developments where these payments are almost immediate and the fees are almost zero. So when you look at that world, you say, wait, why do we need these new forms of money? Why do we need cryptocurrencies? Why do we need blockchain or anything else? So I think what we've seen in some countries in recent years is not that new anymore, is a completely rehaul of the old payment system running through banks in a way that, to be honest, at least from my perspective, it offers everything that people wanted. It offers real-time payments in a way that is transparent, with accountability, at a cost which is practically zero.
I guess let's wrap up on this note then. When it comes to the proponents of Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, it's essentially that it's separated from the influence of central bankers. There's a limited amount of it, or there will be a limited amount of Bitcoin in the world. So the value is really just predicated on demand and supply. There's no monetary policy. You can't print extra Bitcoin or produce extra Bitcoin there. What do you think is going to be the role of Bitcoin in the future? It doesn't look like it's going anywhere, and it's being treated like more of a hedge or like a commodity like gold instead of a currency. Where do you see Bitcoin's role in the general financial system being?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I'm pessimistic on Bitcoin. I've been pessimistic from the beginning for two reasons. I think the technology, as we had discussed earlier, is complicated. I don't think it solves everything that it's supposed to solve. And I think it's complicated for regular people to use. But the second issue is the one that you just raised, which is Bitcoin was supposed to sort of replace central banks, challenge central banks by not printing Bitcoins at the same speed as regular currencies. Is supposed to offer some advantage to people. Now, as an economist, I know that that makes no sense. It makes no economic sense. Central banks manage liquidity. They are allowed and they are able to control the liquidity, what people call printing money, although most of this money is not printed because it's digital, but they are allowed to control the amount of money in the economy for a good reason, because you need that. You need more liquidity when an economy becomes bigger. All economies are growing. As economies grow, you need more liquidity. The idea of a fixed supply of Bitcoins does not sit well with accepted and proven economic theory. So it is a model which is, it defies economic logic. The idea that you're going to have some fixed supply of Bitcoin at some point in the future, it's just not a solution to anything. In fact, it is a problem. You do not want central banks to have their hands tied. We've tried that model before. We've had things like the gold standard, where central banks did not have any discretion, and it didn't work very well for all of us, not just for the central banks.
Antonio, on that note, thank you so much for your time. A fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much.
I was speaking with Antonio Fatas, Professor of Economics at INSEAD, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanisan for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.